Bring in show music, please.
This is Squawk Pod. I'm CNBC producer Zach Felici. Today on our podcast, the CDC is reporting that the COVID-19 Delta variant can spread as easily as chickenpox and causes more severe infection. Former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb on the spread.
I wouldn't be surprised if on the whole we're infecting up to a million people a day right now. We're just picking up less than a tenth of that.
And what that all means for those long-awaited travel plans. Staying safe in the air with Spirit Airlines CEO Ted Christie.
We obviously don't have the authority to mandate vaccines for travelers. We're strongly encouraging all our team members to get vaccinated for sure.
And in the wake of Robinhood's IPO, some investors didn't get the warm market welcome they were expecting.
Robin hoodwinked. Let's come up with something else.
Those stories, plus drama at the box office. Or actually without the box office, talking about Scarlett Johansson's drama with Disney.
I'm with ScarJo on this, big time.
I think I'm with ScarJo too.
It's Friday, July 30th, 2021. Squawk Pod begins right now.
Stand Andrew by in 3, 2, 1, cue Andrew.
Good morning and welcome to Squawk Box right here on CNBC. I'm Andrew Ross Sorkin along with Joe Kern, and Becky's off today. We got a big show ahead though.
Robinhood, the stock trading app, debuted on the NASDAQ yesterday.
On behalf of Baiju and the entire Robinhood team, thank you.
It opened at $38 a share.
It's official now. Robinhood is a publicly traded company. Stock is open for business. $38.
That's right, trading now around $37.50, although you can see it's moving quite significantly.
And closed the first day down more than 8%. CEO Vlad Tenev was on the pod yesterday. Here's part of what he had to tell us about how Robinhood, which offers users no money upfront on buy or sell trades, brings in revenue. It sends customers orders to high-speed trading firms and then receives payments of even fractions of pennies.
We're going to have to keep a dialogue with the public, with the media about what payment for order flow is. I think you've probably seen me over the past couple of months engaging more openly in the topic, and the truth is I think it could be better explained, and we could continue to do that, and I think we'll continue defending it as something that has led to a much greater diverse set of people participating in the markets. And I think from a business level, you'll see Robinhood continue to diversify its business lines and its revenue over time.
So Robinhood didn't have a great first day. Its lofty valuation, pricing at the low end of the range, was supposed to coax more investors into the bid, but instead it signaled that investors were balking at the deal. And then there was the complexity of the retail allocation, the little guy investors, among the highest ever in an IPO traded via Robinhood's own IPO Access platform. It left less firepower and momentum for day one. Usually, bankers can count on retail to come in and help the stock pop after it begins trading. Let's get back to Andrew and Joe.
There have now been about 7 IPOs this year that raised $2 billion or more, and all of them ended their first day underwater. So part of it is a size issue. Another part of it is the pricing issue. But Robinhood did get a vote of confidence from one closely watched investor, and that is Cathie Woods. Her flagship ARK Innovation ETF buying almost 1.3 million shares of that company yesterday. Based on the closing price, that gave ARK more than a $45 million stake in the company. But Joe, you said it yesterday, you know, part of it's, you know, we looked at the $38 price and you said, you know, do you do that because you're hoping for a pop? Do you do that because that's what you guaranteed them and told them that's the worst they're going to get? I think Goldman had a struggle to get this thing out. And part of the other issue is when you're going to allocate at minimum 20% of the stock to the retail audience to begin with, the question is, are there more buyers on the other side, retail buyers on the other side?
I have so many thoughts about this, but I'm going to defer to you because I know you were, you know, watching every tick and watching as it opened and monitoring and making calls. I was watching something much worse, and that was the Yankees game. That's neither, 14 to nothing, but let's not talk about that. I'm not a fan anyway, but the worst performing IPO of the big ones since MF yep. Global in 2007. Now, yesterday, we're nice, we want to give people the benefit of the doubt. But we saw this, right? And you were watching, and we were actually asking, should we even say, is there an issue? And they're saying, no, no, no. And Goldman face meat egg. Can I say that, or can I not say that?
You just said it, and I think it can be said. I think this is one of those times, and this is the hard part. If you're a bank underwriting one of these things, you tell the client that you can guarantee him a certain price, and you try. And the question is, have you set your numbers too high? And I think in this instance, they did. The truth of the matter, though, is, and we all look at these as one day issues, and so I will be sympathetic in this regard. It's very possible 6 months from now, a year from now, the stock will be materially higher. It could be. It could be lower. We don't know. But I always think about that because I do remember after the Facebook IPO, and that was a demonstrable debacle, I remember talking to James Gorman, the CEO of Morgan Stanley, and he said, you know what, call me in a year.
Right.
And he wasn't totally wrong about that either.
The you got the business model maybe holds up, maybe not, hopefully. The moat holds up, maybe so, maybe not. The regulatory issues don't become a problem. Just yesterday it was, all right, you're trying to sell something for a lot of money versus what people thought it was worth a year ago. And a lot's happened in the last year, but really it tripled. The valuation tripled in the last year. So no matter how you want to shake it, you're selling this thing for $32 billion. And it's not worth that anymore. But isn't that the overriding issue about whether is it today worth $32 billion? And if it's not,
well, I think that's the question, and it may or may not be. The other piece of it, though, this was one of those offerings where raising cash mattered. Raising cash mattered because if you remember, they had to effectively try to pay back some of the money from earlier during the whole GameStop situation. And they wanted that cash. This was a firm that actually needed the raise and probably needed the raise more than others. A fight is taking place in Hollywood. Disney firing back at Scarlett Johansson, who is now suing the company, the actress, alleging the movie studio breached its contract with her when it offered the film Black Widow on streaming at the same time that it played in theaters. But Disney says there is no merit to the suit, maintaining it had fully complied with the actor's contract. Johansson's lawsuit, arguing the dual release strategy for Black Widow, reduced her compensation because her pay was based partly on box office receipts from what was supposed to be an exclusive run in theaters. We should also mention the theater chains have come out publicly and said that Black Widow would have made more money.
You see that
had
number,
they windowed
Andrew?
It.
You see that number?
$50 million.
That would get your attention. If you were thinking if it was 50 less, I'm with ScarJo on this big time.
I'm with ScarJo too. You look at the contract. You also look at some of the email traffic that's embedded in that suit.
You see Disney. Really, that's very callous of you to not accept $50 million less when the world is suffering from. You know, Disney company. Disney's had a rough go of it. Remember, they were the perfect company in 2018 until 2020 came along. And it's like, whoa, you got some really bad things here for a pandemic.
Well, look, this is the whole debate. And Jason Kilar at Warner Media got in the middle of it, too, when they started to release some of their pictures all stream them at the same time. But he went to a lot of the artists, not all of them, because there was a lot of blowback, too, to try to make deals with them early on. Disney apparently didn't try to make a deal with Scarlett Johansson to say, okay, we're going to go do it over here. And by the way, therefore, the numbers are not going to be as good. And if you're going to do it, maybe we'll make it up to some other way.
Is it going to be a settlement or what's going to happen?
I don't know. I assume if you're Disney, you try to settle, but I'm not sure. You tell me, what do you think the publicity
is? I don't know.
What does the publicity cost you?
You want to do Black Widow 2, you better, that's chump change for Disney.
Well,
there's
that, but there's also, if you don't settle,
and
you're going to create precedent.
Yeah.
And every other actor in America that's been involved in any of these films that had similar deals. Now, not everybody has back-end deals at the same level that she does, but you'd imagine that they'd come forth, too. So there's a bit of a chess game here.
Do all the streaming companies have this problem? I don't want to argue too vociferously for the actors if all the streaming companies are facing the same thing. I don't want to be too strident about this. Because if it happened, you know, if it happened to one of our streaming things, I'd be, you know, wait, what's this actor thinking of? You know what I mean?
I don't know.
Lucky that they got a job in the...
I think the actors in Fast and Furious, for example, are being taken care of, but
Dr. Death.
I'm not sure.
Dr. Death, baby. Yep. Have you tuned into that yet?
Right there on Peacock. Yep. Well, I was a listener of the podcast originally, and so now I've seen a little bit, but I haven't seen enough.
I'm afraid to get a haircut now. I don't want anyone doing anything to me. Honestly, I'm scared.
Next on Squawk Pod, former FDA Commissioner Scott Gottlieb on the Delta variant dilemma and updated mask guidance from the CDC.
A lot of people who are vaccinated have been behaving as if they're impervious to the infection, even in the setting of Delta.
We'll be back after this.
Stand by, Joe.
You're listening to Squawk Pod.
One, his mic, cue.
Good morning and welcome back to Squawk Box here on CNBC. I'm Joe Kernan along with Andrew Ross Sorkin. We're not really demographically very correct, Sorkin, but we've been doing it a long time. They got to give us some slack one day, right? Is that okay? Becky's off. She'll be back. Can we just be? It's all
just
right. It's okay
you
for
and me.
Us. Just the two
just
of us.
Just the boys.
Just bear with us.
Let's talk about some of the COVID news because we're continuing to learn more about the Delta variant, and it is concerning. Some internal CDC documents now reportedly say that Delta appears to cause more severe illness than earlier variants of the virus and spreads as easily as chickenpox. The Washington Post reporting those documents, according to that report, vaccinated individuals infected with Delta may be able to transmit the virus just as easily as those who are unvaccinated. The report also noting a higher risk of hospitalization and death among older people, regardless of vaccination status. NBC has reached out to the CDC for comment, and we're going to talk a lot more about this, as you might imagine. But if true, raises all sorts of questions about the return to work and other issues as we try to get this country back open. And just as we're getting back open, Joe, it feels that there's parts of it. We talked about yesterday, you know, Disney announcing that you got to wear a mask indoors, whether you're vaccinated or not.
Your anecdote matches up, the one you were talking about yesterday, matches up with the Provincetown anecdote where there was a July 4th celebration, mostly vaccinated people, and a lot of people came down with it. So that the CDC saw that, and they really didn't tell anyone what they were talking about, and they made that move out of an abundance of caution or panic, whichever you want to call it. The Post, and you know the Post, Rupert Murdoch, but I don't know if you got the Post today. They did some numbers, though, Andrew, and they did a little chart for it. And they talked about 161 million people vaxxed. And the breakthrough at this point, 5,601 up here, a little corner, were breakthrough and were hospitalized. Breakthrough and hospitalized. And then out of the 161 million, 1,141 people died at 0.007%. You know what we're learning, Andrew, about the vaccines, and the CDC's got a PR problem because you're trying to get people to take this thing,
and if it
doesn't work, then you have a tough sales job. But let's talk about this. When you get the vaccine, do you think the vaccine is a therapeutic? Do you think it attacks COVID? No. It gets your immune system to make things that attack COVID. If you're immunocompromised or you're over a certain age, or if you've had an underlying condition, you've got anything that compromises your immune system, of course the vaccine is going to be less effective because it's getting you to fight the virus. It's not itself. So I don't, you know, have you noticed that Gottlieb has been kind of sanguine about our ability to deal with Delta? Because he hasn't been...
But He says we're mostly through it, though.
He says we're probably mostly through
it. He's been very positive, thinking that we might have peaked and that we might be coming down. Joining us right now, Dr. Scott Gottlieb, former FDA commissioner and a CNBC contributor. He also serves on the boards of Pfizer and Illumina. Doctor, if the war has changed, what do we need to do to change?
Well, I think the documents that were released in the Washington Post, that were CDC documents, really conform with what we've been saying and what we suspected for weeks. And what we saw in some of the data that was being released by Israel and other countries and was being also collected by academic groups, I don't think that this really changes the truth. I think what this changes is CDC's willingness to acknowledge that truth. So the vaccines still work very well. They showed a 25, even the CDC's data that was leaked to the Washington Post, they showed a 25-fold reduction in the risk of death, a 25-fold reduction in the risk of hospitalization, an 8-fold reduction in the risk of disease. What we know, or what we've believed, and what we now know more fully based on this information that was unfortunately not released in a controlled fashion from CDC, is that vaccinated people are developing infection, and vaccinated people in certain situations are transmitting the infection. And we've been talking about this for weeks now, Andrew, on this show, that there was probably more infection occurring among vaccinated people than was being detected. The vaccinated people, by and large, are not getting sick, or when they get sick, they're just developing mild symptoms, but they can catch and spread the infection. And so that has to change how even a vaccinated individual judges their individual risk. If you're vaccinated and you're around people who are vulnerable, you have very young kids, you're around older people for whom the vaccines may be declining in effectiveness, you need to be careful. You need to take precautions to both prevent yourself from getting infected and prevent yourself from potentially spreading the infection if you're unknowingly infected. And that means testing, it means mask wearing, it means taking prudent precautions. I don't think it means putting everyone who's vaccinated in masks. I think it means giving guidance to people on how to selectively reduce their risk.
Doctor, one of the big questions is, as you know, so many people getting back to work in office spaces and the like, some now, some post Labor Day, at least that was the initial plan. We're seeing some companies push that back already. You're going to have parents that have kids that are unvaccinated. What are they supposed to do?
Yeah, this is the challenge. A lot of kids are in camp right now or away in camp, and so they're in sheltered environments. Once they get back into school and once their parents get back to work and when they're in settings where they can be more likely to catch the infection, there's going to be more risk. You know, a lot of people who are vaccinated have been behaving as if they're impervious to the infection, even in the setting of Delta. And so, you know, hopefully this information, the acknowledgement of this information, is going to cause even vaccinated individuals to be a little bit more cautious in saying this Delta wave. I still think this Delta wave, we're further into this than we believe, that this Delta wave will pass at some point, probably in September. You know, it's going to coincide with the start of school and when businesses wanted to restart, but I think some of that's going to probably get pushed off. I think businesses that wanted to restart right after the holiday in September might push it off 2 weeks ago on a sort of a two-week basis, reassessing the environment. If you look at the CDC's models that were leaked to the Washington Post, they assumed that 50% of the infections that are being reported to the agency and to public health authorities. That's wildly high. I suspect probably 1 in 10 infections is actually getting reported. So the CDC's assessments of where we are and what we should be doing is based on what I believe is a faulty assumption about how much infection they're actually diagnosing. I think they're diagnosing far less, which means we're further into this and many more people have been infected with this Delta variant. I wouldn't be surprised if, on the whole, we're infecting up to 1 million people a day right now, and we're just picking up maybe a tenth of that or less than a tenth of that.
1 million people a day, if that's the case then, and it's not showing up in the numbers, is that considered a better result, a worse result? That's staggering.
Yeah. What it reflects is a reality where you have a highly transmissible variant that's widely spread across the U.S. right now, that's spreading mostly in a population that's either vaccinated and developing mild symptoms or no symptoms at all, or spreading in a younger population that also is less likely to develop symptoms because they're younger, healthier. Most of the spread and most of the people who are showing up in the hospital are younger people. If that's where the infection's occurring, then there must be a lot more infection underneath the small numerator that's showing up in the hospital.
Scott, real quick, set us a timeline in terms of booster shots and kids, let's say 5 to 12. When do you think that those shots will become available to the public? And do you think that they will do enough to change the dynamic?
Yeah, look, this is my personal opinion. I'm not speaking for Pfizer or based on my, you know, sort of FDA prior role. I believe that we should be giving boosters to the vulnerable elderly right around now. I think we should have been, you know, boosting the people who lived in nursing homes who were vaccinated in December. There's clear evidence now of declining vaccine efficacy in an older population over time. Right. The CDC's own slides demonstrated that. So I think boosters for older individuals, we should start operationalizing that right now. Israel decided to do that. They're giving boosters to those over the age of 65. In terms of kids under the age of 12, based on what FDA said publicly about wanting more longer-term data around those vaccines, I suspect that's not going to be available until the winter, maybe midwinter. So I think the vaccines are now available for kids 12 and above. Most of the spread or a lot of the outbreaks that we saw in schools were in high school, so you do have the opportunity to get the vaccines into the high schools and the middle schools. It's just going to be the elementary schools where you're not going to be able to get vaccines into.
Dr. Gottlieb, we got to run. We look forward to talking to you hopefully again on Monday. I know we want to talk about therapeutics with you as well. We appreciate your perspective on all this as always. Thank you.
Cheese will be next.
Next on Squawk Pod, the Delta variant and our long overdue vacations. Spirit Airlines CEO Ted Christie on traveler vaccines and getting back out there.
Since the beginning of the pandemic, leisure traffic has led the recovery. And Spirit is a leisure-based airline. And that traffic has really rebounded quite quickly.
We'll be right back. Welcome back to Squawk Pod. Here's Joe Kernan.
Spirit Airlines topping second quarter estimates on both lines. The company also expanding its operations in New York's LaGuardia and opening service at Miami International Airport in the last quarter. However, rising COVID cases could threaten the airline's momentum. Joining us now, Ted Christie, Spirit Airlines president and CEO. Good to see you, sir. And I'll just start out by asking you, is it the same deal with the low-cost carriers like Spirit as it is with what we think of as legacy carriers? Must be mostly the same trying to deal with these very daunting issues, but there must be some differences too. I don't know whether you do as much international travel or business travel, et cetera.
Well, thanks for having me on. Good morning, everybody. It's great to be here. We did just report our earnings report, so we're excited to see momentum. To your point and to your question, since the beginning of the pandemic, leisure traffic has led the recovery, and Spirit is a leisure based airline. So we're focused mostly on big leisure destinations in the lower 48, as well as in near field Latin America and the Caribbean. And that traffic has really rebounded quite quickly. We've had a very, very busy summer, a very strong booking summer. So it's been great to see full airplanes, full airports, people moving again, seeing their family and friends.
Costs might be more magnified at the low cost guys. Jet fuel, for example. You have different issues maybe than the rest of the carriers. Did you lay off people? Was it very difficult at the height of the pandemic for Spirit trying to maintain such a low cost structure and keep employees?
Well, it's one of our favorite topics around here. We are a low cost carrier. That's what we're about, because we want to deliver low fares to the people that fly on our airplanes. And so we maintain a pretty rigorous focus on that, pandemic or not. That's been something that we're all about. We certainly faced challenges over the course of the last year, maintaining, like you said, operations and trying to figure out ways to move the network around that aligned with wherever we were seeing demand. But we did not furlough any of our frontline staff. We were able to keep everybody intact, which put us in a good position to take advantage of the rebound we've seen of late. And we're managing our cost structure very well, I believe. By the time we hit the middle part of next year, our unit costs will be back down below 6 cents, which is an important threshold for low-cost carriers, and puts us in a leadership position to start again growing and delivering low fares.
What do you foresee in terms of dealing with this new strain? And I guess masks are they've never come off inside the plane at this point anyway, have they?
That's correct. Yeah, we've had a mandatory facial covering requirement in place since the early part of the pandemic. So no change there for passengers on board aircraft. Rising case counts with regard to the Delta variant obviously is a concern for everybody. Obviously, the answer to that, we believe, is to get your vaccine. Make sure you get out there and get vaccinated. One of the problems that the aviation industry saw early on during the pandemic were really restrictions put in place, jurisdictional restrictions on travel, where they were basically cutting off the opportunity to travel. That's simply not the case today. There is, incremental facial covering requirements perhaps coming back into the marketplace, but the market is still open. People can go and see their family and friends. They can go and see the great outdoors. And I think that's a different setup than where we were earlier on.
Ted, curious where you stand on vaccine mandates. We're seeing a number of cities and states required for their municipal workers. Of course, the airline industry was supported by the U.S. taxpayer during this period. And Alan Dershowitz was on Fox last night saying every passenger should be required to be vaccinated in addition to a mask. Why don't you do it?
So we obviously don't have the authority to mandate vaccines for travelers. And as it relates to
our
Spirit team,
Ted, you have absolute authority to mandate.
That's going to be a federal question, I believe. And we can address what we're doing here within Spirit. And we're strongly encouraging all our team members to get vaccinated for sure. And the hope is that, you know, the mix of that, plus, of course, this recent drive to put more facial coverings in place really to kind of dampen the spread of the Delta variant. We can kind of get back to business. But we stand behind that. We think it is the right answer for people to go out and get their vaccine.
Ted, just so I understand and the public understands, why do you think that you don't have the authority to mandate it for the passengers on your plane?
I don't have all the, you know, the legal answers in front of me right now. We believe that the federal government, Raleigh, is going to be best addressing that issue for all the traveling public. But for now, that hasn't come up. We haven't heard that from our regulators. The focus has been on maintaining service, facial coverings on board the aircraft. We do a lot of things on the airplane to ensure the safety of our traveling public. The air quality on board aircraft is amongst the best in the country. We have regular disinfection procedures on board all the aircraft. So the airlines have done a lot of things to put in place.
But you don't, Ted, you don't require it for your employees, right?
We do not have mandatory vaccines for our employees. As I said earlier, we have strongly encouraged our team members.
But that you could require if you wanted to.
We could.
And you wanted to actually, you could, right? That's not federally mandated.
That's correct. Yeah, we could we could do that. We've evaluated that. For now, we're taking a position. We think it's best that we encourage those folks to go get their vaccines. And I know a lot of companies around the country are evaluating whether or not where they stand on that. So that's a fluid discussion. But nonetheless, you know, our focus right now has always been on the safety of our team members and our guests on board the aircraft. We've taken a lot of steps as an industry and as a company to put that in place. We feel good about where we stand today.
I just want to get one more thing in. I get it. Do you serve alcohol on Spirit? What's with the unruly passenger explosion? What's happening there?
It's certainly a very good, it's a big news story that there has been an uptick in unruly passengers, broadly speaking, across the space in airports and on airlines. It's still the vast, vast minority of people. We're proud of the way our team has been handling those limited events on board Spirit aircraft. The FAA has taken a very strong stance on that as well. We support them in making sure that they, you know, they avoid those issues also.
You probably don't have first class, but don't put any kids in first class. I know Andrew gets quite unruly if they're.
Well, don't want that.
Thanks, Ted. See ya, Andrew. Right? Andrew?
I'm never going to live that down.
That's Squawk Pod for today. Thanks for listening. Squawk Box is hosted by Joe Kernan, Becky Quick, and Andrew Ross Sorkin. Tune in weekday mornings on CNBC at 6 Eastern. To get the smartest takes and analysis from our TV show right to your ears, listen and follow Squawk Pod wherever you get your podcasts. We'll meet you back here on Monday. Have a good weekend.
We are clear. Thanks, guys.